Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Alexis Madrigal. Millions of Americans are leaving their jobs. Hundreds of thousands more are organizing for union representation or striking over wages, workplace safety, and corporate culture. Is this a short, sharp reaction to the pandemic, or is this something bigger? American workers are now flexing their muscles for the first time in decades, wrote former Labor Secretary Robert Reich in a recent op-ed, calling this a national general strike. Well, of sorts. We'll dig into it this hour on Forum, right after the news. This is Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Alexis Madrigal. Consumer demand for all sorts of products and services is spiking as the pandemic loosens its grip on the U.S. The stock markets are going gangbusters. Schools are back in business. So why are employers, big and small, having such a hard time finding and keeping workers? Labor is having a moment, you might say, even though many of the individual efforts are proving unsuccessful against big, heavily capitalized companies. Disorganized or organized, American workers now have bargaining leverage to do better, writes former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, who joins us today to talk about the way many Americans appear to be rethinking our working lives post-pandemic. Robert Reich, thank you for being here today.
Well, good morning, Rachel. Thank you for asking me.
Let's talk about that bargaining leverage you were talking about or writing about in The Guardian recently. For instance, healthcare. We've seen labor actions over COVID-19 protocols, staffing, and pay. Organized labor appears to be busy organizing, but is it winning?
A very good question. We don't really know over the long term. There are many strikes in America right now, an unusual number of strikes across the board, not only in the service industries like nursing, but also in big, you know, sort of capital intensive businesses like John Deere. But whether those strikes result in success and higher wages and better working conditions, well, time will tell. We do know that American employers desperate to find workers have increased wages over the past year by about an average of $1 an hour. That may not sound like very much, but it cumulates. It's cumulative, and $1 an hour is important. And the trend is, to me at least, given my values, it's in the right direction. The bottom half of the workforce in terms of their earnings has not had an increase in wages adjusted for inflation now for about 40 years. In fact, if you look, went back 40 years, the typical male worker in America who was on an hourly wage, and again, most people are actually on hourly wages, was earning about what he is earning today adjusted for inflation. Meanwhile, the economy has grown dramatically. So if the question is, do American workers deserve a raise? The question, there's no question, they do. It's all a matter of bargaining leverage. It's a matter of power. And what we're seeing, Rachel, coming out of this pandemic is much more labor working power, worker power than we've seen coming out of anything since, I suppose the best analogy is World War II.
Well, that's going back a long time, though, right? I mean, and you see, for instance, I'm going to pick out something that I've covered as a tech reporter, Amazon, especially thanks to its warehouses and its shipping, has become one of the biggest employers in the United States and in California as well. And we've seen Amazon, upping its hourly wages, but not really appearing to change attitudes about trying to squeeze the most productivity out of its warehouse workers with algorithms, to the extent where, you know, yeah, maybe you're getting an extra dollar an hour, but you're giving up the health of your back if you stick with Amazon. Are the menu of options really improving for working class Americans?
Well, I probably not, Rachel, and I don't mean to be a downer about this, but it's very easy to look at the strike activity and to look at the very high quit rate. That's something else we ought to be talking about, because we've almost never seen in this country the number or percentage of workers who are quitting their jobs. And we have a very, very kind of almost record low what's called labor participation rate. That's the percentage of workers who are in jobs, or working age people in jobs, or who are looking for jobs. Very, very low right now. So if you look across the board, you might say, well, something very dramatic is happening. And I do agree something very dramatic is happening, but whether that changes ultimately the power relationships between most workers and most employers is very debatable. And I'm on the side that I don't see it fundamentally changing anything.
What changes do you think the giant infrastructure bill the Biden administration is pushing might have on this conversation, if you will, between employers and employees, or maybe not? Maybe it's not likely to change much of anything.
In the short term, anything that stokes demand for workers and that $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, and if it's ever passed, the 1.4 or 5, or the number keeps changing, social infrastructure bill, both of those are going to increase the demand for workers across the board. And that, generally speaking, is always good for American workers. So you have just looking at supply and demand, you've got pent-up demand by American consumers for all sorts of goods and services they didn't really have a chance to get during the pandemic. And on the other side of the equation, you've got employers who are desperate for workers in order to satisfy that pent-up demand. And if you add to that additional spending by the government, that is good for workers. That creates even additional demand on the top of constrained and limited supply. So in the short term, that means higher wages for many, many workers. It means better working conditions. It means better contracts. But who exactly is going to benefit? I don't know. Rachel, the kind of workers that you spent a lot of time reporting on, high-tech workers, particularly knowledge-intensive workers, they are in a very good position. They have been for years. They're going to continue to be in a very good position. But whether the Amazon warehouse workers are going to get much better off because of this labor shortage is a good question.
You know, I've seen people commenting online. Corporate America wants to frame this as a labor shortage, But as you've written, there's another way to frame it, which is that, you know, what we've got is a living wage shortage, but also a hazard pay shortage, a child care shortage. That's a big one for women who are participating in the economy, or perhaps these days not so much. A paid sick leave shortage, a health care shortage. I mean, we are really talking about whether it's possible to have a decent life working in America today.
Exactly. And I think what's happened is that the demise of organized labor, I mean, today, only 6.2% of private sector workers are unionized. Now, that's down from 33% in the 1960s. So you don't have much power. I mean, unions have very, very little power in terms of demanding changes. They have a lot of power right this moment in particular industries, given the imbalance between supply and demand. But over time, whether unions really will come back, whether unions will provide workers that kind of power to overcome the real shortages, and as you said, and I did write, what's really happening is not a labor shortage per se, it's that workers are demanding much more, and they I think, deserve it. They deserve a living wage. They deserve hazard pay, child care, paid sick leave. We're the only country, rich country in the world that doesn't provide these kinds of things, and also health care. And the pandemic, I think, helped open people's eyes, Rachel, to one other aspect of all of this. And that is that, you know, we don't work to live. We certainly don't live to work. A lot of people are reassessing their lives right now. Now, I don't have any good data on this. We don't, the economics profession, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, nobody collects data on how people feel about their lives and their work at that level of kind of existentialism. But from my free-floating focus group, and I do a lot of talking to a lot of people across the country, very informally, I've detected a big change. And I don't know quite how to talk about this, except simply to say that a lot of people are reevaluating work and reevaluating their lives. They don't want to, you know, they're saying to themselves, life is short. I mean, we see this during the pandemic. We are reminded of it. We don't want to spend our lives doing nothing but thinking about working or worrying about working or having hours that are simply unpredictable. We don't want employers to be treating us like they have been treating us for so many years. I think all of this kind of reevaluation also lies behind what we're now seeing.
We're talking with Robert Reich, professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley and former Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, about worker discontent and the future of American labor. Have your feelings about your job changed since the advent of the pandemic? What kind of benefits or policies would keep you at your job today? Give us a ring and join the conversation. We're at 866-733-6786. Now that you're ready with the phone, 866-733-6786. Or you can get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. You can email your questions to forum@kqed.org. You know, Professor, I would say unions are not a monolith, but we've seen corporate America pushing unions back on their heels, so to speak, for decades now. But we seem to be in a moment where there's a kind of ground level, widespread discontent. It's almost like individual Americans themselves are at the front edges of this conversation or this argument.
Absolutely, Rachel. And again, you only look at the data came out just last week on the quit rate. Now, we've never seen in this country a percentage of workers who are quitting their jobs as we are seeing now. Now, many of them are finding new jobs. Some of them are taking time off. We also see, as I mentioned before, a very, very low rate of labor participation. People who are of working age, they've decided for one reason or another to take some time off. And on top of that, we see the strike activity. And in many high-tech firms, Rachel, I'm very interested. We see employees who are saying to their employers, you must change your ways with regard to business practices.
And that's something we're going to get right back to. We're talking with Robert Reich here on Forum. Stay with us.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, and we're talking with Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. I say we're talking with him because you are welcome to join this conversation and put your questions, put your challenges to Reich today. Give us a ring at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can, of course, email your questions to Forum at kqed.org, and we are monitoring our accounts on Facebook and Twitter. So you were just talking there, Robert Reich, about the tech universe. And one of the things that we have seen in terms of the way big tech has evolved, especially here in the Bay Area over recent decades, is we're no longer talking about, you know, everybody at Google having the same kind of access to the cafeterias and the masseuses and right, the free dry cleaning. There are different layers. There's a hierarchy. There are people who work not directly for Google, but for subcontractors. And when I say Google, I mean we're talking a lot of companies. Now, many American workers find themselves not directly employed by a company, and therefore, you know, at a disadvantage in terms of pressing for greater worker rights.
Yes, and the move by companies to contract out more and more worker, more and more of their work, does create a much more rigid hierarchy because many of these independent contractors are not entitled to any labor protections, Rachel. They don't get a minimum wage. They don't get necessarily, they're not eligible for workers' compensation for injury. They don't, or they're not covered by OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. They really are, many of them, on their own in a kind of a labor system that predates the 20th century.
Well, you know, but you could also say that this reflects a choice or a lack of choice on the part of labor regulators at the state and federal levels.
Well, if you look at what Lyft, for example, and Uber did with the California legislature, they kind of put something on the California ballot, which created a free ride, if you will, for Uber and Lyft and other organizations, other major employers who wanted to move their workers off of their employment status and treat everybody as contract workers. Well, the California legislature didn't want them to do that, and there had been some litigation that prohibited them from doing that. But what did they do? Well, they spent $200 million, and they got it on the ballot, and they persuaded enough people to vote their way, and that's a political choice, but it is using their power. I think there is fundamentally, Rachel, here, some question here, many questions of power, and I want to go back to this theme. Because we don't talk about it nearly enough in our society. When we're talking about employers and employees, particularly big businesses, what's happening to the relationship between big businesses and their employees, there has been, over the last 40, 50 years, a fundamental shift in power in America. 50 years ago, most American employees had more power, either directly through their unions, or indirectly through a kind of an accepted social contract post-World War II. Employees were treated better. They were considered to be a part of the social contract in the sense that employers would not and could not and should not take advantage of them the ways that employers have since the late 70s, early 1980s. We built in those three decades after the Second World War the world's biggest middle class. We had never seen anything like it. It kept our economy and society going. It built our entire post-World War I understanding of how our economy works and how our society should work. All of that was reversed in the late 70s, early 1980s. And what we're seeing now is perhaps, it's a big perhaps, the beginning of a reaction against those years in which power was so predominantly in the hands of big employers.
Well, on that moderately hopeful note, the phone lines are lighting up, Professor. So let's get busy answering caller questions and discussing listener comments. Why don't we start with Dave in Sacramento? Hi, Dave.
Can you hear me? Hey, hi, you there?
Yes.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Just a comment here. So I actually work in a one of those kind of high-tech industries, a lot of, and my partner, they did not, they worked at a retail position. This is pre-pandemic. And when that pandemic hit, people in my kind of position were helping others and telling them, because we were, you know, we were pretty understanding that the pandemic's going to change the world, that this is the time that the world is shuffling. And to, you know, you should position yourself in a place where when the pandemic, when you get to the other side, you're at a place where you want to be, whether it's your work or your, you know, it was kind of, this is an opportunity to take away some of that taboo and shame away from quitting your job and moving to a place that you want to do. There's a silver lining in it. And I think some people are recognizing that now and seeing that.
That's a great point, Dave. I mean, it does seem, Robert Reich, that a lot of people have used the opportunities presented by the pandemic to hit the reset button on their careers.
I think that's right, Rachel. Again, very, very difficult to measure. It's certainly true anecdotally. You know it from people who are working remotely, who now have many, many more options for where they work. And it's also clear, to me at least, that in the wake of so much hardship and illness and death, people's priorities have shifted. And many people are willing to live maybe more simply, maybe slightly less materialistically. Perhaps people are saying to themselves, life is more than work, and it has to be more than work. You know, interestingly, there was a similar phenomenon. I don't remember it, but I've read about it. After the two world wars, World War II, you had, right after World War II, not only a great incidence, increase of strikes, but also, anecdotally, a lot of people changed their occupations, they changed their ways of life, they thought differently about what they wanted from life. And perhaps we're seeing the same thing as this pandemic hopefully winds down.
Robert writes, workers are simply sick and tired of being sick and tired. Charles writes, is this mostly happening in the upper class? Is it the luxury of being able to reevaluate the role of works in our lives? Or is this also happening in lower pay grades?
It's a good question, and we don't know enough about it. But if you look at the strikes that are occurring, some of them, many of them, are in relatively low-wage service areas. If you look at, for example, well, go back, Rachel, you know about the Bessemer strike in Alabama, in an Amazon warehouse. Amazon and Walmart are anti-union. They have been very virulently anti-union. But they are finding themselves with more and more disruption from their hourly workers. And I think that's true of, well, nurses are going on strike. Nurses have been extraordinarily valiant heroes and heroines during this pandemic. And many nurses are either going on strike or they're leaving nursing altogether. Again, we don't know whether it's burnout or it's kind of a fundamental reckoning and reevaluation.
Curtis writes, trickle-down economics never trickled down to workers. Job creators didn't create more jobs. This is the first time I can recall where labor has had such a strong hand in their own futures. What measures should progressive leaders implement to make sure this moment doesn't pass without real change? And I'm going to use that comment, Robert, to go to one of our callers, Sharon in Napa.
Hi. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Yeah.
Okay. My comments were there. You had a television program on KQED years ago called Building a Business, and two businesses that were, highlighted was one was Ben & Jerry's. And when they built their business model, they stipulated that the highest paid person in the company, meaning the owners, would never make more than five times what the lowest paid person in the company was paid. And the other one was an international harvester company they rehabbed engines and motor parts for the harvesters, and all the people in the factory were partners in profit sharing. And so they felt that, you know, the harder they worked, the more money they got, and they had a basis for really investing in their work. And these are two things that are just, I think, lost today, because you've got these CEOs that are being paid $16 million a year for sitting at a desk and flying around in their corporate jets and stuff. And the poor schlep at the bottom is only making $5.25 an hour. So that's just a comment. I don't know if I want to respond to that. But
thank you for that, Sharon. I mean, I guess, Robert, in some ways, what Sharon is talking about, there are obviously some wonderful, thoughtful, progressive employers out there in the U.S. operating today. But it does seem like the exceptions still manage to prove the rule.
Yes, and unfortunately, and I want to agree with Sharon, the exceptions really are, in a sense, sad exceptions. And many of them are finding it more and more difficult to maintain their businesses because they're at a competitive disadvantage from all of the other employers and businesses that are taking advantage of their workers, squeezing their workers, not giving pay increases, not being flexible in terms of scheduling, not providing safe work environments. And this race to the bottom has got to stop. Now, you asked me, Rachel, just before you took Sharon's call, what can be done? And interestingly, there are a number of measures right now before Congress. Look at paid family leave, for example. I'm interested in that issue just because the first law that I helped implement under the Bill Clinton administration was family leave, family medical leave. We got 12 weeks of unpaid leave. Now, at the time, that was considered to be a great victory, but a lot of people, and the pandemic has made it very clear, desperately need paid leave. We're the only country in the world, in terms of rich countries, that does not offer paid family and medical leave as a matter of law. Now, the irony is that 6 months ago, Joe Biden promised, and he thought he could get 12 weeks of paid family leave. We had had the experience of the pandemic so literally and so passionately and clearly. People wanted it and needed it. But he announced last night that he had to whittle that back to just 4 weeks of paid leave. And he wasn't even sure he could do that. He would that would be paid leave for many years, at least available. He could only make sure that it was available for 1 year. Well, that, to me, is emblematic of what's happening right now in this country. Why are these things being whittled back? Why are these worker protections in the current bill, in the social infrastructure, the Build Back Better bill, why are they being whittled back? There are many issues that Americans, particularly working Americans, care about. Childcare is being, at this moment, as we speak, Democrats are getting together and saying, well, maybe we can't afford childcare. Working people need these things. And the great irony is that as we have, the quit rate is going up, people are on strike, many people are saying we really have to reevaluate our jobs. In Washington, the move is in the opposite direction, to provide less help to many American workers.
Well, it does seem like a lot of workers are starting to think, well, there's no way even a Democratic administration is going to save us from the abuses of the marketplace in terms of labor. You think about it, right? Like, where is the regulation? Where is the taxation of companies that stops them from using social services as a backstop to poor pay and benefits for their workforce, while the folks in the boardroom walk away with billions? It seems to indicate that, you know, as many people suspect, government is simply bought and paid for by big corporate interests.
Sad to say, I mean, I want to make sure that anyone's listening to this understands that most of the Democratic senators in Washington are supportive of these reforms, but there's not a single Republican senator who is supportive of these reforms. There are two Democratic senators that are holding everything up, as far as I can tell, Kyrsten Sinema and also Joe Manchin from West Virginia. But nevertheless, these are things that American workers need. In California, there are better labor protections than in most other states. But still, we have millions of workers who are treated as costs to be cut rather than as assets to be developed. And a modern, enlightened business leader would think very differently about their workers.
Linda asks, please clarify, how can people just quit their jobs or decide to take time off? How does one live or raise a family with no income? I understand all the reasons for this, but how does it work?
Well, Linda, that's a very good question. The evidence we have suggests that during the pandemic, some workers managed to save. They didn't spend nearly as much. Some workers did take advantage in a positive way of some government aid and support, and they saved a little bit of that. Also, there are others who have said to themselves, look, I don't want to live the kind of life I am living. I don't want to pay as much rent. I want to move to a place that is cheaper to live, and I'm going to try to get a job that is just as good as the job I had before. So there is a lot of change going on right now. And I think, Linda, my response to your question is that although most Americans are still living paycheck to paycheck, and most Americans don't have the luxury of quitting their jobs or the luxury of deciding, I want to change my life. What's happening now is maybe an indication of a bigger change in the future.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, and we're talking today with Robert Reich, professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley and former Secretary of Labor under President Clinton. We're talking about worker discontent and the future of American labor. Has your employer improved or changed its policies to retain workers? Are you a member of a union? Do you want your workplace to unionize? Call us. Join the conversation. 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook or at KQED Forum. Or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. But whatever you do, stay with us.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Myrow, and we're talking with Robert Reich today about American labor, the past, the present, but also especially now as we round towards the end of the hour, the future. So with that, I want to go to one of our callers, Nan in Napa. Hi, Nan. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for taking my call. I don't know that we've spoken about the future of robotics and its impact on the workforce of the coming years, and I think that's another long-term, maybe it's a near-term threat or certainly a dynamic that will impact workers, and certainly if you could just speak to that.
Thank you so much. That's a great set of questions there. Robert, any thoughts? I mean, we see not just robots, but also, it must be said, software seems to be displacing an awful lot of people, or at the very least, just making their lives much more miserable.
Well, undoubtedly, robotics and artificial intelligence are coming into the workplace, and they are... Well, they're taking away, the good news is that they are likely, and they already have taken away some jobs that people don't want to do. I mean, that are pretty back-breaking and mind-numbing. But the long-term future suggests that they will be taking away more and more jobs. Or perhaps to make it a little bit more accurate, it's not that they're going to take away jobs. There's still going to be enough jobs for people to do, but the quality of those jobs in terms of pay is probably going to decline over time because of artificial intelligence and robotics and all sorts of technology. Now, what's the future then? Well, I'm a great fan of something called the universal basic income, because it seems to me that we have no choice eventually in this country or really anywhere around the world. As artificial intelligence takes over more and more work, we're going to have a way to provide people with at least a basic income so that they can, you know, not only satisfy their own needs and their family's needs, but also keep the economy going. I mean, who's going to, you know, I mean, if you think about it, and you think about just a handful of owners of technology dominating the entire economy, that won't work, because who's going to buy all of the things they have to sell?
But Robert, in a world where even a Democratic administration can't push through paid family leave improvements, how are we to imagine something like universal basic income becoming a reality?
Ah, Rachel, well, that's the interesting question, isn't it? I mean, do we have to wait until the business community, and I'm talking about major CEOs, big businesses, the people who are now lobbying intensively against Biden's program for working people in Washington, do we have to wait until they see their enlightened self-interest in all of these reforms? That may take many, many years. Or is it going to take some sort of a political revolution? Or are we in store for... heaven forbid, another kind of Donald Trump authoritarian strongman. I don't know. If I were young today, I think I'd be very excited, because none of this, what we're seeing now is not sustainable. Let's put it that way.
It is hard to imagine a populist who is, unlike Trump, not affiliated with big business getting to the White House. But that said, Bill writes, with inflation running over 5%, it seems we are all all we are seeing is the beginning of wage inflation catching up with consumer prices. How is that going to leave workers better off if inflation continues to increase?
Well, Bill is exactly right with that question. If inflation continues to increase, or if we have accelerating inflation in terms of price increases, then those wage increases don't mean very much. I think that much of the price increase we're now witnessing, though, is temporary. It has to do with supply bottlenecks. You have this great, great pent-up demand from consumers for all kinds of goods and services after, let's hope, for after the pandemic, or as the pandemic winds down. At the same time, you have around the world, and this happened really after the Second World War as well, just it takes a while to get all of these supply chains back working. And if they're not back working, one little gap in the supply chain can make it impossible for all sorts of producers of all sorts of things to actually produce what they want. I mean, look what's happening with automobiles. Automobiles are in great demand now, but the supply bottleneck seems to be in semiconductors, little tiny semiconductors, mostly coming from places like Taiwan. Well, as long as you've got these supply bottlenecks, you're going to have price increases. But in 6 months' time, and that's my estimate, we're going to see an end to these price increases. Supply will catch up with demand.
We've got a comment now from one of your former students at Harvard, I believe. Stuart writes, one of the issues not being discussed is globalization and international competition. They make it more difficult to provide the kinds of benefits prevalent with unions in the 1970s. This isn't true for all industries, especially high-margin tech, but it is true for lower-margin industrial companies. How does Dr. Reich feel a low-margin company can compete with rising labor costs and a highly competitive environment?
Well, Stuart, it's good to have your question, and you obviously learned a lot in my question. That's the kind of question I would have asked you. I think the evolution of the American workforce shows that if you have a college degree, you are in one world. You're essentially ready for a lifelong system of learning and keeping up with what is becoming a more technological intensive economy, necessarily, because as Stuart suggests, the rest of the world is filling in with a lot of the commodities, a lot of the lower tech kind of work and all of the products and services that go with that work. But if you are not a college-educated person, you are likely to find yourself in the personal service sector of the economy, in which you are providing attention, you are providing, retail or restaurant or hotel or surface transportation, or you are in healthcare. Now, these are all critically important, but these personal service occupations tend not to be terribly productive in terms of generating a great deal of revenue. So in really dollars and cents terms, these people in personal service sectors are not earning very much money and they are the ones in our economy who really need a union more than almost anybody else.
Why don't we go to the phones again and Dale in San Francisco. Hi, Dale.
Yes.
Hi. Thank you for waiting.
Yep. My comment was just we keep talking about why these policies can't be enacted, and I keep circling back to Citizens United and that decision and how, you know, the corporations keep getting what they want because we're considering them people too. And it seems like the politicians aren't enacting what we need because they're not being empowered to do so by their corporate backers.
Thoughts?
Well, Dale is absolutely right. I mean, everything connects to everything else, and big corporations have more political power than ever before, at least since the 1880s, 1890s, what we used to call the Gilded Age. We're in a new Gilded Age right now. Big corporations and the moneyed interests in America are calling many of the shots, and they will continue to do so until and unless they are stopped. There is a bill in front of the Senate right now called the Freedom to Vote Act. Now, that act would provide some reform of campaign finance, Dale. And I hope you are behind it. And I hope people know about it. And I hope they are calling their representatives and senators and telling them to make sure that that Freedom to Vote Act is enacted.
Let's take another call now. Charlie, also in San Francisco.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm sure Professor Reich is familiar with Arthur Schlesinger's cycles theory, and that every 40 years we swing, America swings between private interest and public purpose. And I think we're long overdue now for this swing to public purpose, I think, which was blocked by the backlash to President Obama. That's my opinion. I've seen how the next generation is thinking differently. I teach as well, and I wonder if this doesn't confirm your thinking about the change we now see.
Well, Charlie,
public purpose.
Yeah, I certainly hope that we see the great pendulum that Arthur Schlesinger wrote about moving in the direction of public purpose and away from kind of private greed and acquisitiveness. But as you pointed out, we are way overdue in terms of Arthur Schlesinger's 40-year cycle. We've been about 60 years now. And we do, I think that what he thought of was that we, you know, that the cumulative negatives, the downsides of private acquisitiveness and corporate overreach reach a point where there is no sustainability, and the country obviously shifts. As the country did, as America did shift after the Gilded Age, the first Gilded Age, we had a progressive era. And what gives me hope, honestly, is as a teacher, as a professor, not only at Berkeley, I mean, I do guest lecturing around the country, and I am so encouraged by the generation of young people I'm now teaching. I've been teaching on and off for 45 or 50 years. The people who I am now teaching are the most committed and determined young people I've ever come across in my teaching career. They are determined to change America, heal America, make America work, improve democracy, and make sure there is prosperity for everyone, that it's spread broadly. Now, they may not actually succeed, but they're going to fight for it. And that makes me, well, makes me optimistic.
But now, you mentioned the first Gilded Age, Robert, but to my mind, and you may correct me here, I believe what brought that to an end were arguably a couple of guys you might call traitors to their class. Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and this is like decades after the first Gilded Age began. I suppose that's more of a great man theory of history than hoping that some change comes from the bottom up.
Yes, I think the they certainly, Teddy Roosevelt and then his fifth cousin, Franklin D. Roosevelt, certainly helped propel the great move of the pendulum. But it was also the muckrakers, we call them investigative reporters today, that reported on the doings of the rapacious capitalists of the Gilded Age. You know, an earlier caller mentioned that today CEOs are earning vast sums, more than they earned in the 60s and 70s. When I first began investigating all of this, teaching about it and working in government, the typical CEO of a large company earned 40 times what the typical worker earned. Today, it's 300 times. Workers do not have power. There is no countervailing power to corporate power of the sort that we are seeing in Washington and even in Sacramento. And that countervailing power is critical. It was critical after the Gilded Age, and it is critical now. We've got to build that back up.
Well, that kind of throws it back on the media, I suppose. Why don't we look at a few comments now? We've got Christopher writing, lawmakers in D.C. are telling the American people that passing of the so-called reconciliation bill would negatively impact the current inflationary environment. More money flowing in the economy right now equals bad, right? I don't know about you, but most of us are sick and tired of being told there's nothing left for us after the rich have taken their cut. The same conversation was thrashed out before we got any stimulus, after corporations had had been handily bailed out, can taxing the rich, as proposed by Biden, with the wealth transfer that brings from private to public purse, aid the control of inflation? That's a lot to unpack there, I know.
Well, it's a lot impacted. But I think the point is that although prices are rising in response to these supply shortages and bottlenecks, this is not a permanent accelerating inflationary environment. And everybody who is worried about inflation, I understand their worries, but it is misplaced. Inflation, you know, the old type of inflation we used to worry about was when labor unions were very strong, when we had wage price inflation, when inflationary expectations got built into almost every contract. Those days are gone.
Those days are gone. So, you know, in our closing moments, do you have advice to somebody who is perhaps struggling, may not be in a position where he or she or they can step away from work, but wants to, I don't want to say get ahead, you know, build a decent life for themselves in this current context with so many questions about power differentials yet to be answered in Washington, D.C.?
Rachel, there is no formula here. I think that the old axiom about getting an education is certainly true today. It's certainly as true today as it was 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. And if you can get a college degree, fine. But it seems inappropriate to live in a society in which everybody has to get a college degree in order to succeed or join the middle class. And that's where I think technical education, community colleges, and also businesses that are offering the equivalent of internships and apprenticeships really do come in. I mean, we've got to, as a society, bring more people into the circle of prosperity. We cannot have a system in which we have a handful, really a handful of billionaires who, over the course of the pandemic, increased their wealth by, well, what was it, $2.1 trillion. And, you know, we're talking about Biden's plan that is now under $2 trillion. It's been whittled back. So our 750 billionaires in this country increased their fortunes by more than Biden is now trying to push a plan that would help most workers, most people in this country. Well, it's absurd. As I've said before, and I said just over the course of this hour, it's not sustainable.
It's not sustainable. We have to leave it there. Robert Reich, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, Rachel.
Forum is produced by Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, Ariana Prale, Blanca Torres, and Grace Wan. Judy Campbell is lead producer for the 9 o'clock hour. Our engineers are Danny Bringer, Katie McMurrin, Brendan Willard, and Chris Hoff. Our interns are Kimia Akbare and Jennifer Ng. Our executive editor is Ethan Tovin Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with guest host Leslie McClurg.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.